During the early months of the coronavirus pandemic, folks were comparing it to the Spanish flu of 1918, saying that at the end of the pandemic, it would be just like the Roaring Twenties all over again. We'd roll our stockings down, rouge up our knees, and all that jazz. So why don't we feel like dancing the Charleston again?
Today, Dr. Stephen Thrasher, professor of journalism and LGBTQ health at Northwestern University, joins us to look at the coronavirus pandemic and the changes we've experienced since he last visited with us a year ago. In Stephen's new book, The Viral Underclass: How Racism, Ableism, and Capitalism Plague Humans on the Margins, he takes a look at the impact of the pandemic on marginalized people.
Plus, if the sexual harassment charges weren't a bad enough reason, New York's Governor Cuomo should resign after his mishandling of the COVID pandemic.
Glenn Close and her wig get nominated for both an Oscar and a Razzie for Hillbilly Elegy.
And does Meghan Markle and Prince Harry's interview with Oprah do enough to highlight systemic racism? I'm Fausto Fernos.
I'm Mark Fillion.
And this is Feast of Fun.
Hello?
Hi, is this Dr. Stephen Thrasher?
This is he. How are you doing?
Hi, Dr. Stephen. This is Fausto.
And Mark from Feast of Fun. It's a pleasure to have you on the podcast. And congratulations.
So
you're welcome. And congratulations on your new gig as a writer for Scientific American.
Thank you. Thank you. It's been a good venue for me as a guest, and I'm excited to have a regular outlet with them.
Oh, are you talking about us or them?
Well, it's been a year since you came on. March 24th, you came on last year, just as this pandemic.
Has anything happened in the past year? I haven't had it.
Well, you came on to talk about, you know, the pandemic and the start of it and some of the health disparities between, like, poor and LGBTQ Americans and in the United States. And just calling to check in and see how things are going.
Is it over yet?
It's not over. It's looking a lot better in the U.S. Yeah, I'm remembering now when we spoke, I had just talked at the Bernie Sanders rally, I think. Mm-hmm. That was, you know, kind of my last public outing with 15,000 other people. And it's been quite a year ever since. Mm. It's not over, but I think we're looking at some better times in the United States in the next few months, hopefully.
So, Stephen, in the beginning months of the pandemic, there was a lot of uncertainty, and you certainly had a lot of interesting things to say back then. Has anything changed in the past year in your experience in covering the coronavirus pandemic as opposed to looking at the AIDS pandemic as it was managed by Mike Pence in Indiana?
One of the things that I learned, along with lots of other people, even though my virologist colleagues would have known this sooner than me, but these were two very, very different viruses, and you know, they behaved very differently. We, this time last year, knew much less about the novel coronavirus. It's a respiratory virus. HIV is a retrovirus. They're such different viruses, mm-hmm. That one would think that they would affect very different populations, but something that did turn out to be true is they affected very similar populations. There's a geriatric component to the coronavirus. The two viruses in the book I'm now writing, and actually just finished writing and should be out early next year, you know, are about how, even though these are such different viruses, ended up affecting like very similar populations of vulnerable people. And so I think that shows how big a role the social structures play in the life of viruses, particularly in the United States, which ended up being, you know, none of us knew how things would shake out this time last year, but the United States ended up being the country with the most coronavirus cases and deaths. And I'm not actually sure where it stands right now. It's jockeyed back and forth with a couple other countries, you know, but it's been one of, and many times, clearly the most affected country per capita in the world as well. Mm-hmm.
The book is Viral Underclass: How Racism, Ableism, and Capitalism Plague Humans on the Margins.
That's it.
That's a hell of a title. And so what I was really struck about it in this past year, and I'm curious to hear your thoughts on it, especially now that we have vaccines and we're starting to see how Republicans politicize not wearing masks initially. First, they said it was a fake it was a hoax. It was a fake virus. Then they said that wearing masks don't do anything. And then they said, well, the pandemic is over, so you can go back to taking the masks off. And now they're saying you don't even need to take the vaccine. Part of it is, I think the realization for them is that they're seeing that this pandemic is targeting the people they want to see hurt. And the mindset of a lot of Republicans, especially like white supremacists we're talking about here, is that if it's going to harm a person of color, I'm going to let it harm me too, because it makes me happy. It brings me pleasure to see a person of color be harmed.
Yeah, there's a lot there. There's a lot to pull on.
Whole book, right?
Yeah. So, you know, in some ways, I agree with everything that you're saying. There is a lot of Republican direct, you know, allowance for harm, but it's not as straightforward in terms of what they're saying and what they're doing. So now we're finding out that many people, including the president and First Lady, did get vaccinated. You know, privately, they're getting themselves vaccinated. They're taking advantage of this form of prophylactics.
You mean Trump and Melania Trump, right?
Right. Sorry. Yes. The former president. I'm not saying he's the true president.
March 6th came and went, right?
Yeah. No, I'm not saying you. But while he was still the president, he did get himself vaccinated on the down low. You know, and so did the First Lady at the time. They didn't talk about it. And I think I was just seeing this story about the governor of Florida, I believe, you know, donors to him getting vaccinated. So, you know, some of them know full well what they're doing, and they want to protect themselves, even though they're saying something different for their constituents than for themselves. You know, in lots of ways, the way that Trump and Pence were behaving, particularly Trump, you know, were just full on putting their foot to the gas pedal on the car, trying to go over the cliff. You know, but at the same time, one of the things I'm really dealing with the book, and I'm struggling to deal with, and I think that there are issues in Illinois where, you know, not as actually as much with Governor Pritzker as there is with Mayor Lightfoot, but certainly in New York State, where I lived for almost a quarter of a century, there are all these ways that Democratic behavior influence the proliferation of this virus in ways that are not, the ends were quite similar, even if the means weren't the same. For example, with Governor Cuomo, you know, before sort of we get to his current scandals, of which there are many, you know, he was a very fiscal-minded austerity hawk who cut about 10,000 hospital beds over the time he was governor, which is one of the reasons why the hospital system almost collapsed. It wasn't under his watch, but very interestingly, right before he became the governor, St. Vincent's Hospital was closed in New York State. And that did happen still under, you know, Democratic administration from the state. And St. Vincent's, as I'm sure you remember, was one of the first, along with Ward B in San Francisco, one of the hospitals that attended to people with AIDS. It had the most AIDS deaths for a very long time in the world. I don't think it does internationally anymore, but it did for a long time. And it was a, you know, very formidable force in protecting people, being with people who had AIDS, of course, had a long activist history, and also just being a community hospital. And those kinds of hospitals, you know, when they closed, those beds would have come in handy at the time when Governor Cuomo was sending people with COVID into nursing homes, which, of course, ended up being a reason why so many people died of nursing homes, particularly in New York State. Only three states chose to send people with COVID into nursing homes: New York, New Jersey, and Michigan. And they all had statistically far higher rates of nursing home deaths. And there, I think, like, one thing that's interesting to think about that both the Democrats and the Republicans did, which has similar structural issues, I think, around AIDS. It's not exactly the same population, but these are people considered disposable, right? Capitalism has no need for them. They've already lived their life as workers. A lot of the same things were said about, you know, gay men at the time. They don't reproduce. They're not family men. They're not, you know, part of increasing society in a healthy way.
As J-Lo says, we're the party people on the dance floor. And so, you know, because at the time of the 80s, at the height of the AIDS crisis, people didn't think of LGBTQ people as part of the economy.
Right. And so there's one of the people who trained me in my PhD program, Lisa Dugan, who's a very leading queer theorist and historian, coined the term homonormativity. You know, a lot of her research is really about the ways that heterosexuality is very tied into a certain kind of reproducing capitalism and reproducing a profitable family that's going to recreate the next generation of consumers who will create the next generation of consumers. And so there was a lot of ways that gay people were just considered disposable, not just because they were thought to be sinful, but that they were thought to be wasteful to the economy. And certainly, in a bipartisan way, old people are considered, wasteful to the economy now. But I do have to say, even though I was a Bernie Sanders person, mm-hmm. and I was very critical of Joe Biden, and of course I'm very disappointed and sad that even the modest increase to $15 an hour did not make it through this bill. Otherwise, lots of things in this bill, the $1.9 trillion Recovery Act, are very good at redistributing money and in supporting not just the medical infrastructure for dealing with the pandemic, but also dealing with the local and state governments and helping capitalize them so that they can continue to do things that that serve people and keep them from becoming sick and keep them from being in a position where they're going to be affected by viruses in the first place.
Well, what really struck me when we first had you on is the comparisons you were making between the AIDS crisis as it took place in Indiana and what we were facing with the COVID pandemic. And in the months following the COVID pandemic, there was a lot of comparisons being made to the Spanish flu and the Roaring Twenties. A lot of Vox, NPR, New York Times were saying, like, this time next year, we're going to be having speakeasies and dancing and having a good time, rolling up our knickers and singing.
Rouging our knees.
Yeah, rouging our knees and rolling our stockings up and all that jazz. And instead, I don't feel like doing the Charleston. You know what I'm saying? Like, there's a profound sadness. There's a loss of friendships and jobs. There's loss of social skills. And it seems like decadent now, or even almost out of touch, would be like saying, I just want to sit in a jacuzzi and drink a martini.
Yeah, can I ask you a question? Tell me about because I hear people talking about this in different ways. Tell me how you are thinking about the loss of friendships that happened. Are you thinking literally in terms of people who died, or also of friendships that fell away because you found that you had a different expression of values?
Definitely, all the above. And it was sort of interesting that I was always thinking, it was like, who's the major celebrity death that's going to frame and define the pandemic, for at least for me? In the height of the AIDS crisis, I remember when Magic Johnson said he was HIV positive, and I said, this is going to change how people think about HIV and AIDS. And when Terrence McNally, who is a big figure in New York City's Broadway scene, is a famous playwright, and a friend of my family's, he's like a gay uncle to me.
Oh, I didn't know that, yeah.
And when he passed away from COVID, I was like, this is really interesting, because in a lot of ways it was symbolizing the shutting down of theater all across America. And it was about the loss of these legends that certainly Terrence's health was not that great to begin with at that time. He was suffering with cancer, lung cancer.
And yeah, he actually was honored at my graduation.
Right.
When I finished at NYU, I don't know, 7 or 8 months before that, and he looked extremely frail even then, although I was glad he was able to come out and get the prize, but he was wheeled out in a wheelchair.
So Fausto's mother and he were friends in high school, maintained that friendship, and if you've ever seen Corpus Christi or read Corpus Christi, the character of Patricia is based on Fausto's mother.
Oh, wow.
My favorite character that's based on anybody is me. And that is in Love, Valor, Compassion, the Ramon Fornos, the Puerto Rican international performance artist. And I was like, this is a little generous, isn't it?
And so that's a family friend. But then you look at like how our lives have just been shut down. And, we talk about like Facebook and Twitter and stuff like that, that they're social networks. But, we have these real live social networks. We have communities all around us. There's the people at the gym, the grocery store, the coffee shop, your friends that you run into only at parties, that those kinds of people, they all add a little bit to your life. And, you know, when you're deprived of them for a year, I think it makes a difference. You know, it always used to be like, you know, if you're ever depressed, just get out of the house. You'll run into some friends and you'll run into people, you know, maybe it'll lift your spirits. And then it's just been hard to do that in the past year because you're like, where do I go? What do I do?
Yeah, like Petula Clark's downtown, you know? Downtown is where you avoid the coronavirus. Stay home, you know? Well, and so there's a loss of, like, yeah, you know, the community web, you know? Intellect. You know, the we're all sort of isolated in these little machines of capitalism pressuring us to sacrifice our well-being for its system. And in 1912, during the Spanish flu, like every headline that you're reading right now today, like, you know, retail stores and, you know, businesses are opening up too early and the mayor of New York didn't do enough to protect people from the pandemic. And like everything, it feels like history repeating itself to the point that it's like people don't even remember the Spanish flu.
Well, and most people are dead.
Well, it was only 100 years ago.
Yeah, you know? But most people are dead.
And so I think it's really interesting that somebody like you, you know, who's been chronicling all this stuff is, you know, getting this really amazing platform in Scientific American, which I consider kind of like the New York Times of scientific journals. Is, you know, for me as a young child, I would read the Scientific American from front to back, you know, and it introduces a lot of really important ideas to a lot of different people that other scientific journals don't. And so I'm really excited about seeing you writing about the pandemic and the political impact of that for this journal.
And your first article that you wrote was calling on Andrew Cuomo to resign.
Yeah, hopefully that will come to pass, but probably not. Or I think if he leaves office, he'll be removed out. I don't think he'll go willingly. Mm. And first of all, my condolences on Terrence McNally, and I think that going to, you know, for many people, it is interesting that here to see a pretty strong difference between Democrats and Republicans, right? Like, I'm very hard on Democrats, but the Democrats do have some sense of collective mourning. They have a better sense of science. And so, you know, for the Republicans, you might think when Herman Cain died, you know, who had run for president, was very, you know, I would say, among the five most recognizable African-American Republicans, not that there are that many, right. But, you know, certainly a very important figure in that party. And it had no empathy blip, you know, whatsoever. I mean, he kept tweeting, you know, him, quote unquote, you know, from beyond the grave after he was dead.
Because he had so many tweets to advertisers. And so those ads had to run.
You know, see, he's tweeting from beyond the grave. Yeah. In complete denial of the seriousness of the situation. Mm. And so I think that, you know, when I was hearing you talk about how are people going to reconnect with friends, there's so many things I don't think we can actually predict. There are just so many things that we don't know exactly what's going to happen. Lots of public health matters, including public health and emotional health, are going to have extreme, you know, variations and weird things that we're going to see, but we can't predict what all of them are going to be. And so I think in terms of, you know, friendships, I think in one sense, people have gotten very alienated. There's been really good, much more widely circulated research about, you know, casual friendships. Now I'm forgetting the technical term they use about low stakes friendships, you know, and how much and low stakes interactions, and people realizing, wow, you know, these people that I did see at the gym or that my barista, like, I really cared about that person. I didn't know that much about them, but they were like, you know, a positive force in my life. And there was real human beauty and interaction in our, you know, seeing each other and spending time with each other almost every day that we don't understand until it's gone. And then we realize that was really meaningful to me. And so in some ways, I think that there's going to be a, you know, a renaissance as people re-socialize. It is going to be awkward re-socializing. And I have some thoughts about, particularly for gay people in some ways, gay men.
I'd love to hear that.
So when can I go book my flight to Puerto Vallarta and not get canceled on Facebook?
Right. Yeah. So there's that. Once we have better data about the power of the vaccination to curb onward transmission, that's when that's going to be which I think is going to come. But
something interesting that's also happening is that people are starting to lie about being vaccinated. They're like, oh, I've been vaccinated. I'm like, I'm pretty sure you haven't.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm mostly giving people the benefit of the doubt, but we should all be, which is one of the lessons that we learned from, you know, that we learned from AIDS, is that we should be practicing universal precautions, certainly, you know, for the rest of 2021 and probably early 2022. And certainly until there's much better data on how much protection that these vaccines are going to give us against onward transmission. But in terms, you know, to come back to friendships, I think for a lot of people, it is going to be tender and wonderful. And I think I write about it in my book. I had a very close mentor of mine who actually was not gay or HIV positive, but who edited my early writing on AIDS, you know, who died of coronavirus. And there's a whole chapter in my book about him. And it's awful and stupid. And it did not need to happen. He died in a nursing home under one of, you know, probably via people being, he did not have it when he went into the nursing home. He was recovering from something else. But one of the really magical things that happened was two of my fellow writers at the Village Voice, who, you know, also loved him. Like, we came together to plan his funeral. And since then, we talk on Zoom together, the three of us, every week, you know, and are really much more in each other's lives again. And I was too young at the beginning of AIDS to do this, but I do have lots of friends who, you know, came together in ACT UP or, you know, came together and taking care of someone who was dying. And that created, really powerful and meaningful community. And I think a lot of that has happened with COVID as well. Like, I think we're going to see, you know, as people are allowed sort of safely to gather in small groups again, I think we're going to find that for a lot of people, there have been some fallings out, but there's lots of deep appreciation for being able to be together. And so I think that's going to play into it as well. And what
Stephen,
I was sort of
will
joking,
you be my post COVID friend?
Yes. Well, because I've been dying to meet you for, you know, a year now. So
that makes me happy.
Well, and now you're in Fausto's homeland
in Puerto Rico. Yes,
I am in Puerto Rico. Yeah, I've been here for a few months now.
What are you doing in old San Juan?
I came here to finish my book, and I'm actually doing one of the research institutes that I'm affiliated with at Northwestern University. We actually have some research projects that we oversee here. So I'm doing some field research myself for a little of it'll be in my book, but I think it's actually going to become its own project after this. And
does it involve
was a
tostones
bit of,
or acapurias?
No, it actually involves...
fritters in Spanish.
Yes. No, I'm eating all the octopus for my own enjoyment and all the tostones. But it actually involves something that's really important, and there are all kinds of problems with around the United States. Puerto Rico is doing a very good job with it. As Puerto Rico has pretty consistently among the 57, 58 U.S. states and territories is either the lowest or near the lowest rate of COVID. But they've done a really good job with harm reduction, with continuing to do needle exchange. And that is becoming a problem. There's a cluster outbreak in upstate New York right now that's come from reduced funding and reduced access to syringe exchange. There are some issues in West Virginia, which I'm writing about in my book as well. I mean, we just don't have the data on it yet, but by and large, the people I talk to who do syringe exchange and who do harm reduction services that were around HIV and hepatitis primarily, but also around addiction, overdose deaths, things of that matter. Their work was so interrupted by COVID, and social support and actual connection to people is so important for that kind of work that's going to become and is becoming a real crisis. So I'm doing some research on that here as well. But also for me, it was like part of my own ability to kind of stay healthy this year. I have lived alone. I have not been inside with another person for a year, which is, been a challenge. In warm weather, when I was in Chicago and also in New York last year, in warm weather, I would go out and see people. But I did not go inside with other folks. And so I was not feeling great about, you know, staying inside by myself all winter long. I didn't have kind of an easy, amongst the people I'm close to, there wasn't, for various reasons, like, really easy for me to join a pod. You know, one person I'm really close with also lived with someone who's very compromised, you know, immune-wise. So I isolated for 2 weeks and got an N95 and a face mask and got a COVID test and then came to Puerto Rico. And I've been I'm staying here, I think, until about May. And I've been doing some field research outside. But it has been kind of a lifesaver for me, even though I don't know many people here, just to be able to go outside. And so as someone who lives alone, you know, I think I'm finding people's experience with the pandemic are either they were alone entirely or they were never alone. Mm. And those are both like, you know, those are both very challenging things. Mm. You know, but for me, for someone who, you know, lives alone and it's been like, I've had a lot of death in my family. My mother, my father, my stepmother, and one of my sisters are all deceased. I've worked through that grief in various ways. But as I've talked to other people who've gone through grief, it really has brought it back in the pandemic in a lot of ways. Mm. You know, it's made me very grateful in some ways for lots of the memories I have, and it's made me able, having to gone through some of that grief, to be with other people and their grief. But I did find that I thought I'm not going to do well if I'm like in the cold north. You know, for the whole winter, not seeing anybody. So at least I've been very grateful here in San Juan that I can go outside and everybody wears masks here, even outside. And, you know, it's nice to see life.
They take it seriously. Yeah. That Fausto's niece was living down there. She got a $5,000 fine. For being on the beach.
You put my family's business on blast.
For being on the beach with her friend early in the pandemic. And it's because I spoke Spanish to the guy. If I had just spoken English to him, she would have thought I was a gringo and not thought anything about it. But they waived the fine. They were just kind of like, this is, you know, you need to take this serious,
right?
You know?
Yeah.
And so they waived it. But is there a good vaccine rollout down there? Because, you know, a lot of people don't realize that Puerto Rico has some kind of form of universal medicine down there, right?
Yeah, no, they're at about, I believe, about 50% of the population has gotten at least one shot. And numerous, like some of these, like Vieques, I believe, has actually done the entire island. They're trying to do sort of these whole communities at once. So I see National Guard out who are part of the distribution effort. Yeah, and I mean, it's been an interesting thing, and I'm writing about this a little bit in my book too, to see there are some very poor societies and countries that have had, you know, that have collective responses differently than the mainland U.S. So having, I think, gone through Hurricane Maria and the earthquakes, people here are extreme. They're already sort of tied into kind of mutual care networks from that. And they take their fragile healthcare system very seriously, you know, having seen how overwhelmed it's gotten. And there are other, I can't speak as much to Puerto Rico, but there are other countries in sub-Saharan Africa and in places in the world and in Southeast Asia, Cambodia, Vietnam, where they're very poor countries, but the percent of their healthcare goes towards preventative and community medicine, like a very high percent goes into education and prevention. And so people have a relationship with prevention experts and you know, having gone through in some of the countries in Western Africa, you know, having gone through Ebola and having had years, in some cases, decades long education campaigns about Ebola and having put lots of resources into what to do not to get Ebola, when those same people come to you and say, hey, listen, you need to do this around this new virus, they listen to it. Mm-hmm. And they're not, you know, on Fox News saying, like, don't wear a mask and it's all a hoax. Like, you know, the people already have an investment and a relationship to the people mm-hmm. actually do this. Mm-hmm. They trust them, you know, which is very different in the United States, where it's like you only go to the doctor at the absolute, you know, last second to an ER, and you know that you could leave with a bill that could bankrupt you and your children. Mm-hmm. And so that longstanding relationship can make a big difference in how much people, how much buy-in and how much support the general public gives them. And I think there's something like that happens here too.
I understand West Virginia, which is a very poor state, has actually done pretty good with this whole COVID vaccine rollout because of, they have had like that social security network happening.
Yeah, this is actually like a half chapter of my book is actually a case study about a dynamic around this. And West Virginia's had all kinds of problems for various reasons. And I ended up studying them because they've had large-scale HIV outbreaks that happened in tandem with the industrialization and the opioid crisis. But I was really, I'm not going to give away what it is, but there's sort of a surprise in my book where I found out one thing while I was, you know, interviewing someone about how they had been doing their care network. And he made a prediction that when I listened to the tape back again after I saw how well they were doing, that just gave me chills. They're by some metrics the poorest state in the country, but they made a couple of great decisions at the beginning of the rollout, and also just had they relied on their community pharmacies and their networks and did not hew themselves to the big chains right away, like 49 other states, and had the fastest geriatric vaccination rate. We're the first to do their nursing homes in the state. And then correspondingly, they had the first, you know, to see their geriatric death rate starting to plummet because of that. So it's fantastic.
It's interesting that Dr. Fauci and also the head of the CDC are both issuing warnings. This is Rochelle Walensky, have said to states that we're rushing things, that we're reopening too soon. But, you know, other people are saying we're going at the right rate, actually, that because of the rate of vaccination is actually exceeding forecasts, that we're doing this by the book. What's your thoughts on this?
Well, my thoughts are that we want to squash it as much as possible, so we should err on the side of caution. Now, I don't, and my colleague Julia Marcus at Harvard writes and tweets about this very well, we don't want to give into vaccine denialism or vaccine alarmism. You know, so vaccine alarmism is where you actually browbeat people into being so scared that they think, why should I even bother doing it if I still, like, the point of wearing the vaccine is so eventually we can take off the mask and be with other people, and we all know that. But we don't want to rush it, and so I think that I don't think states should be reopening yet. I don't think, you know, large groups should be together, and there's a lot of hubris. You know, there are countries that have actually managed this without a vaccine, notably New Zealand, which has some very particular things to it. It's an island country. They could close their borders. And they have, you know, they're relatively wealthy. But then also Cambodia and Vietnam. Vietnam is what, almost 100 million people, and they've had 35 deaths. And the way that you get there is that you just want to absolutely squash, you know, transmission so that you have so few cases you can actually follow them and deal with them. And we're not going to get that to that level unless we, like, stay with these measures for a while. And one way I think that's, you know, helpful to think about it is, you know, it's going to be, I think, in the next few months, if not sooner, you know, at this vaccination rate, it'll be fine to, like, you know, to get together with a group of 5 people, 10 people. Some of the vaccines are proving to work very well against the variants, but we don't know what all variants are going to come out. And all of the vaccinations are stopping, you know, severe sickness and death, even of the variants, which is great. But what we don't want is, you know, a situation where, let's say, you get together 10,000 people. Now, if you're having a group of 10 people, it's unlikely there's a variant there. If there is, it's going to go to a small number of people. But if you get together, you know, 10,000 people, now maybe you have a variant and like 20 people leave with it, and then they go on and that variant starts moving through their cycles. And then it can create more mutations. And so we don't want to have that happen. We want to be like Cambodia or New Zealand, you know, that sort of deals with it in this moment. And to the extent that there are only a few cases and where they are, we can find them and deal with them. We've basically had for the past year uncontrolled community spread of these viruses. And so, you know, if Texas reopens really quickly, that could certainly happen again. And not everyone, of course, is getting vaccinated. And in terms of large scale events and whatnot, I think those should not happen for some time. You know, particularly because the people who are most likely to be working at them, you know, poor and maybe are contract labor or part-time or minimum wage, you know, they're going to be actually the most, the least likely and the last likely to get vaccinated. Right. And so, like, I'm a member of the American Studies Association. They're supposed to have their annual meeting in November, actually here in Puerto Rico. And I'm asking them, you know, like, please just cancel it now. I don't think people should be planning large events for the rest of the year. One, because we don't know what's going to happen. You know, two, people need to make plans in advance. Three, we do, as you were talking about earlier, like, we need time and space to mourn. And I think that social, in terms of socialization, I really hope there isn't the move on professional organizations to be like, we've lost all this time. You know, we have to fill all this time up. Like, 500,000 people have died. You know, God knows how many of them, how many tens of millions of people were connected to them. And we need space for that. You know, these people's first birthday without them, their first anniversary, like, these things are all going to happen. I think, actually, as people are able to be together again, you know, I predict that a lot of families are maybe going to want to have memorial services, or, you know, friend circles have memorial services that they couldn't have in person, you know, for these people. And so I think that we should just be gentle with the amount of time we have and not feel like, oh, you know, we have all these things on our calendar. Like, we have to get back to the pace we're at. We need to have space and ability to respond to one another gently, you know, for things that we already know are going to come up. But a lot of shit's going to come up that, you know, that we can't predict yet.
Your thoughts on theaters opening up, on restaurants, on retail stores opening up?
Restaurants, I've long thought that restaurant workers should have been the first vaccinated. There was a quite large scale study out of California, which looked at, I think, tens of thousands of people in various jobs, and found actually line cooks was the job that had the highest mortality rate.
I could see so that.
Restaurant, you know,
because basically most of them, like, live in multi-generational families, and they're also working right next to each other, right?
They're working right next to each other in small spaces with bad ventilation. Like, restaurant, for whatever, for diners, you know, it grew relatively safe to eat outside, but, you know, short order cooks were not, there was never good ventilation happening in those kitchens. And then also, they tend to, many, particularly in California, many are undocumented. They live in small spaces with other people who are also working in similar kinds of, you know, face-to-face jobs. So I think that restaurant workers should be vaccinated before they have to be working again. Theaters, I'm not terribly well informed on it, but kind of anecdotally, I certainly am thinking about it as a labor issue, that it seems like for an audience, you could have a 2,000 seat theater, you know, you can probably seat a couple hundred people very safely as audience members. But I do know from my friends who are performers, and particularly wardrobe people and makeup people, that they're also working in very poorly ventilated, extremely tight spaces with each other. So again, as a labor issue, like, I think that they all need to be vaccinated, and not just the performers, but, you know, all the crew members as well. Retail, you know, I really don't care about retail.
Gee, thanks.
But I mean, I care about retail workers.
Yeah.
And again, like, they're the ones that, they should get no less respect than teachers or medical workers. You know, if somebody's working in the Gap, you know, helping people operating a changing room, like, they need to be vaccinated before they're in that little room. And again, they're like, particularly since so many of them are teenagers, you know, they're under 18, and it's going to be a while before vaccinations are available to people under 18. I don't think for teenagers, they're probably going to be available until the fall or the winter. So
it's again, really an issue about ventilation and proximity. So if retail stores do put in adequate ventilation systems and have measures to keep the customers and employees distant from each other, then it's foreseeable that that is a measure that allows them to run to some capacity.
Yeah, I mean, as many of them have been. Mm-hmm. And all of this is also, you know, dependent upon just getting the rate down in the society as a whole. But, you know, right. Retail is much less dangerous than dining because people can keep their masks on. If people are actually keeping their masks on, you know, and I do feel bad for, it's been a very long time since I've worked retail, you know, but I feel really bad for these people who are working in national chains in states where they're open gun laws. You know, where the national chain is saying they will enforce a mask mandate, but the governor of the state has taken it away. I feel really poorly for those people who work retail and are trying to ask customers to put on a mask. It's very unfair.
It's my understanding that, and you know, I can't speak specifically to the names of the retail stores, but they're hiring their own private security. And so if you go like a Walmart or other, you know, electronics store.
Yeah.
There is a armed guard in front, basically like, put your mask on or leave.
Wow.
So part of it is like when I'm shopping or working in a situation, I want to see those measures there because I'm not going to be wanting to be going into a retail store where those measures aren't being enforced. You know, and yeah. I imagine that other people out there would feel the same.
Yeah. And one thing I think that's helpful to remember and can sometimes be help lower anxiety is that none of these measures have to be done 100% to have, you know, really good efficacy. Like if you're in a store and one person takes off their mask, you know, statistically you're not that much more exposed, you know, if there are 99 other people wearing masks. But it is, it's very frightening. I think these states where people can just walk around with guns, and who's going to ask them to put on their mask?
So are you like Lady Gaga's like, you know, there's going to be 100 people in the room. And if one person doesn't believe in you, believe in masks, it doesn't matter. Or what is the opposite of that? But, you know,
right.
What were you looking forward in doing when the pandemic end that you're still kind of hoping to do? For Mark and I think there was a Korean spa that we used to go to and sit in a jacuzzi and decompress, and we really enjoyed like going to that, and obviously that's not a possibility now. Is there some activity that you enjoyed doing in the past that you are looking forward to doing in the future?
Yeah, well, I would like to have sex again. That would be nice. That I can get through. It has been very hard not to touch people in any capacity. And actually, one of the things that I am, which for some reason I think this will speak to you the way that you seem community-minded, I am particularly enjoying, I have an elderly Sicilian friend who's now fully vaccinated in New York. So I'm looking forward to when I get vaccinated and get to visit her, having dinner at her house. And I've talked to her a lot on Zoom. When I saw her last summer, we would go out during the day in the summer, and she would make a picnic lunch, and we would eat outside. But she told me at some point, she's like, I really miss cooking for you in my house.
I miss her cooking for me, too.
Yeah, my friend
What's
Sally.
What's her name and number and address?
Sally, yeah. Sally would love to have you over if you're ever in New York. But, you know, she had said May or June, she said, when she's like, I don't know that I'm going to live until this is possible again. And so I just feel so, you know, grateful that, so that's probably the thing I'm looking forward to the most. And I, you know, as someone who lives alone, you know, I do enjoy those low stakes interactions. I'm looking forward to, you know, like seeing people on SAD and thinking like what businesses are not going to come back.
Think about all those Karens out there who have not been able to yell at a manager this past year.
Right.
Probably yelling right. at their kids.
Unfortunately.
Or neighbors.
Yeah. But I love cooking and like hosting dinner parties and going to people's homes for dinner parties. So I've been grateful that when I was able to go, you know, eat outside, I was very grateful that was a possibility. But I really like, you know, cooking, long conversation, not feeling like you have to leave because the table has to turn over. So, yeah, I'm really looking forward to that. But most of all, Fish Friday at Sally's when she makes seafood and pasta. That's what I'm looking forward to the most.
They announced the Oscars, right? And Glenn Close was nominated for an Oscar and a Razzie. At the same time for Hillbilly Elegy. And this is a you don't care very much for the author, nor for the story or the movie. Could you tell the audience why that is?
Hillbilly Elegy? I mean, I think, to be fair to the movie, I've barely watched anything more than the 45-second clip I put of myself laughing at it.
Yeah, I watched that on Twitter. It was enjoyable.
I think that, you know, Glenn Close, she just looks ridiculous. I actually quite like her as an actor. But it looks so dishonest to me. And I think Hollywood has a really difficult time dealing with poverty or poor people in any way. And the book itself, which I also haven't read, although I've read a lot of critique of it, you know, the guy who wrote it, J.D. Vance, he's engaging in a narrative trope that I generally don't like, which is like, look at what a smart child I was around all these hicks. And, you know, then I grew up and became smart. You know, and he's a Silicon Valley, Wall Street hedge fund guy. He's now exploring the possibility of running for Senate in Ohio, I think. And he's being funded by Peter Thiel, coming back to our gaze. Mm. Peter Thiel is this figure in America that I think is so underappreciated, even though he's been in the news a lot more in the Trump era. He was a gay man who was very close to Trump. He basically took down Gawker. He financed the lawsuit that took down the site Gawker. And he said it was because he didn't like that they outed him. Everyone knew he was gay. They actually didn't like that they were doing finance reporting about his companies. Mm-hmm. And I broke a story about him 12 years ago. I was just re-looking at it, which was like sort of early fusion of the internet with social media. But I was always annoyed that this did not. I felt like it was my first big scoop, and no one really gave a shit.
Welcome to our world.
But the story, which I thought was an important one, was that there's this guy, James O'Keefe, who's a bit more known, who's made all these like sting videos that always turn out to be bullshit. And he had made one about the group Acorn. I don't know if you remember Acorn or if they had a present. Yeah. So he made this video about Acorn. And making them look like they were, he dressed up as a pimp and his partner dressed up as a prostitute. It's so ridiculous. And he made it seem like Acorn was giving money to sex workers when in fact, like none of them gave them any money. One of the Acorn people called, you know, the authorities and said, like, I think something really is wrong happening here, but he made this fake video. And prior to that, he made this horrifically vicious, racist video called Taxpayers Clearinghouse. And do you remember the Publishers Clearinghouse?
Yeah.
So he made a video where he would, after the, he made the big publishers, a check that looked like the big Publishers Clearinghouse check. and he drove it around into poor black neighborhoods and drove up to random people's houses and said, you've won the Taxpayers Clearinghouse. He shoots video of them jumping up and down, like when Ed McMahon gave them a check. But then he presented them with a bill saying, this is the amount of this, of the Obama stimulus bill that you're going to owe, that the debt that's going to be for your children. And he did it just to make black people look stupid and dumb. And it's so racist. And Peter Thiel gave him money to make this video. He gave him like $30,000, $10,000 or $30,000, I'm forgetting. Money to help get him started. And so he's, you know, he helped put James O'Keefe on his way. He helped take down Gawker, which is one of the most critical media sites. And he's now, you know, supporting J.D. Vance. I think that Hillbilly Elegy looks like it fits into a genre of movie that's usually about people of color, where it's Hollywood like beating up on poor people and making them look stupid, and it just seems very dishonest.
It's a polarizing film, right? And you kind of see that how she got a Razzie and an Oscar. There's people that I've seen that they're like, I just loved it. I cried through the whole thing. And other people are just like, this is just pure trash. You know, other people saying, I grew up in communities like this. People are not like this. This does not represent us. This is a guy who went to Yale and, you know, he's made all this money and now he's just trying to distort like the past to make himself seem like he's just some kind of like a wonderful person who overcame all these odds.
Yeah, I like this chapter of mine, which, and hopefully it'll make sense when you read the book, but half of it is set in Appalachia, half of it's set in Athens, Greece. And I'm writing about kind of similar ways that economics is taking a toll through austerity and making people vulnerable to viruses in similar way, in these very different environments that are not white, that are not people of color, that are white environments, but in Europe and in the United States. And I've never met, anytime hillbilly elegy has come up with anyone I know from Appalachia, they are very angry about this movie.
Well, it's almost like the way people in Georgia reacted to the film Deliverance, which is going to be celebrating its 50th year anniversary. It was released in 1972. So that would be 50 years next summer. And and part of it is like it made Burt Reynolds a star, and it portrayed rural people in Georgia as evil. And to this day, they interview people in Georgia, and they're like, it ruined, and it was a blessing and a curse because it brought all this tourism to that area where they filmed the movie. But at the same time, it's like cemented this really horrible perspective on people living in that region.
Well, I have to say that nobody's hair was as bad in Deliverance as Glenn Close's wig in Hillbilly Elegy. And even Brute's chest hair is better than her wig. And the real shocking nomination is that the hair and makeup people got an Oscar nomination for Hillbilly Elegy. That's the one I think is really shocking.
Oh my goodness. I'm curious to hear your thoughts about Meghan Markle's interview with Oprah Winfrey. There's just so much confusion and chaos and opposing viewpoints. Some people sort of positioning Meghan Markle, they're almost kind of like slut shaming her or basically
she's
saying
an opportunist
that she deserves to experience the prejudice and racism of the royal family because she was ignorant. And basically it's like, you deserve to get mugged because you were walking at that part of town at 3 a.m.
I wouldn't go that far. Yeah. She went to Northwestern, so I have to.
She's one of your alumni, right?
Yeah,
yeah. And her father was the director of photography for Married with Children.
Oh, I had no idea.
Yeah.
So I worked for The Guardian for almost 5 years, and I cannot believe that there is a queen. That there's still a royal family. It's so odd to me that this institution still exists. I understand. I, of course, don't wish anything bad to happen to her, mm-hmm. Or anything she experienced. It does seem naive, but what bothers me much less than anything she has to say is that it's disappointing, the language and the narrative, that we have to talk about what racism is, because I've tried to in my career, and at times I felt good about it, particularly actually when I was writing for The Guardian, really writing quite explicitly about race in 2014. I started a week before Michael Brown was killed, and because I'd reported another story recently in St. Louis, they sent me immediately to Ferguson. And over the next year or two, I felt really positively about how journalists, academics, activists, and the general public were thinking about racism structurally, and that it's not just a matter of saying a mean word or doing a quote unquote racist thing, that there are like kind of all these structures that make racism. So it's disappointing. Again, like I don't sort of blame her for this, but it's disappointing seeing like how much of the conversation is about, are they racist? Did they do something racist? Did they say something racist? When like the structure of racism itself is, very embodied in like the whole concept of the royal family, and the way that family in particular, as sort of the incarnation of the British state, was involved in the total extraction of resources from the global South, Asia, sub-Saharan Africa, Northern Africa. And that is the racism, right? The racism is the institution that keeps perpetuating these things. And one of the ways, which again, like I don't want to put this on her directly, but I think it's something for us to understand and think about as we think about the stories we tell ourselves and the narratives that we tell ourselves about race. One of the ways that that gets elided, that sort of the buy-in, the kind of personal feeling buy-in happens, and that we don't look as much across history and economics, is the way that a connection to someone's identity makes us feel a part of it, right? So when Meghan Markle, and I say this as a mixed race, biracial Black person myself, you know, often people of color, lighter skinned people of color, like end up in positions of power where there's a celebratory connection of feeling a sense of connection to them in a way that can often elide looking at the bigger structures. And so like, this is never the fault of the person who's in there, but it is like depressing hearing like how much of the media narrative is, oh yeah, you know, what was said about the skin of her child, who said it. They did something in that which drove me crazy when I worked for The Guardian that I found dealing with British people, is it's sort of a passive aggressive, we're going to say something happened, but not say who. And then you don't know who actually said it. And there's all this speculation about it. yeah. And you know, when the other brother, Prince William, you know, he gets asked, are you racist or not? Oh, no, what else is he going to say other than, no, we're not a racist family? Of course, that's what he's going to say. But like all the questions, that brings us back to saying like, yeah, racism is something you do. Racism is something you say. If you're nice, you're not racist. Which racism isn't something that needs to be seen as like a personal insult that someone can, you know, say the right thing and get out of. Like it's a structure. Mm-hmm. And if any family on earth, you know, represents the structure of who benefits and who is harmed by it, it's certainly, you know, the Windsor-Mountbatten family of the Royal Family of England. Yeah. So that was kind of my feeling about it. But this is the first time I'm even talking about it. The older I get, the more I will say to myself, I don't want to weigh in on that, so I'll just let other people talk about it.
It's the system that you wanted to say, that's in question here. It's not just the personal relationship.
No, it's not just the personal relationship, but of course, the celebration of the personal relationship can elide these other things, right? Mm-hmm. So when, you know, and I'm no more or less guilty of having these things I like in my life either. But when there's like a huge celebration of a royal wedding, that's buying in a lot of tacit support for lots of systems, right? In their case, it's into the notion of an imperial family. But all weddings, you know, create, okay, people who are legally married deserve more rights than other people. And that can become, it's not the case in England because they have the NHS, you know, but in the United States that can become cover for saying, oh yeah, we don't need universal health care because being married is good. And if you marry someone, if you're good to marry someone and they have health insurance, that's how you're going to get health insurance. So I'm always kind of looking at the next level beneath the surface. And certainly with the British royal family, that's, you know, that's going to be part of it. I'm lucky I got to have an education where I got to see how, and also working for The Guardian, there are all these ways that royalty benefits from slavery. And the Brits like to say in 1807, you know, we ended slavery, or they stopped
before America did.
Yeah, they stopped the trade in slavery, I think in 1807, and they stop it entirely, make it illegal in, I don't know, 20 years or so before the United States. But like their entire economy is capitalized by slavery. You know, the finance of London, the middle passage involves ships from London taking money from banks in London, and they go to the west coast of Africa, they turn the money into human beings. The human beings are bought, they take them to the Americas churn them into raw goods. And then those raw goods are taken to London where they are industrialized and turned to cash. Like the entire industrialization of the British economy comes from that. And particularly, there was really good research led by Catherine Hall a few years ago out of England about how when Britain ended slavery, they did pay reparations to the slave owners, not to the enslaved people. The British state bought off the enslaved, bought the enslaved people's freedom, quote unquote, by paying money to the people who own them. And that money was the, at the time, the largest transfer of wealth in the history of human beings went to these people, of which 1,000 members of parliament, you know, benefited from that economically, including, I think, Brown, the prime minister, just a couple back, and many members of the current sitting parliament and members of the royal family. So, like, that is what, you know, racism is. And I would rather, you know, talk about what reparations could look like. Evanston has an interesting but not particularly helpful model of thinking about reparations right now.
Did you say Evanston, you know, the city?
Evanston, the city, is rolling out this sort of a reparations program for homeowners, but it's not applying to very many people. The Biden administration does have, like, kind of a reparations component to deal with how farmland was taken from Black farmers and dealing and giving some money back to them from what was taken away from them. And I think those are better ways to think about what racial justice would look like than whether or not, you know, Meghan Markle's son feels like he's on the same footing as, right, you know, the other child in the royal family, which is not to say that they should be disrespected. But narratively, I'm a little depressed when, like, the story is about the fairy tale and not about the much larger structure, which just affects a lot more people.
And the reason that I'm asking you, and I'm curious to hear your thoughts on it, because, you know, as a mixed race person, when you've experienced racism through your own ambitions or your job or relationships, I imagine that people have blamed you for getting yourself in a situation where you were exposed to it. Like, well, what else did you expect trying to get that job? Of course they're going to be, you know, and I'm curious, like, how you as a person navigated facing that discrimination or adversity.
It's different. I mean, I thought of myself, I sort of use that to compare myself to Meghan Markle. I thought of myself as mixed race or biracial when I was younger. I mostly call myself Black now, you know, and I've had my moments of things I've dealt with, but I do think of it, like, I think of it more historically and structurally, and understanding how that's affected my life. So my, on my father's side of my family, I think on my father's mother's side of my family, like, there was a generation of sharecroppers. I wrote about this once in the New York Times. And there was an incident on the farm where they were, where my great-grandfather helped. You had to have a pass, and he loaned his pass to a friend, and the friend got caught, you know, to travel between farms. And there was a shootout with the overseer and the clan, and his family shot back and actually scared them away. They had to go get more reinforcements. And so, like, they just fled. Like, they left the land that they had worked. They'd worked as enslaved people. They worked as sharecroppers, and they just, like, had to flee for their lives and went north. And that's such a common story, you know, in the United States, of how people, like, lose the land and the wealth they would have built. And so, you know, I think about that. I think about all the things that happened to my father. You know, my grandfather was, my grandparents were illiterate. My dad and his generation all went to college on the GI Bill and, you know, started kind of life with nothing. When my, and then when my dad married my mom, who was white, she was a college student, and she was expelled from college for dating my father because he was Black. So she lost, you know, a college degree, you know, which would have accumulated into an average of $1 million of earnings over her life. So when I start, you know, out life with, you know, on average, you know, 8% of the wealth of white people, like, that's sort of how I think about that's affecting me more. Particularly when I was in graduate school.
And you look at your two portable car, what is it, your Mercedes and your mansion, and you're like, I did pretty well for myself.
Yeah. I mean, now, like, you know, now I'm earning a very good salary. Mm-hmm. I just sold
I'm my happy first to hear book. That, though, oh, you know, that you're,
but
that
I'm,
you're stable.
You know, but I'm 43, you know, yeah. And I went to graduate school, you know, with many people 10, 15 years younger than me. Whatever. People go to graduate school for a variety of reasons. But I was very aware, like, at a certain point, I realized that that almost every Black graduate student I knew had a parent who was dead. And then most of the white graduate students, like, both the parents were alive, often both were professors, or one was a medical doctor, you know, and I was at that point when I was in graduate school, I was supporting my sister before she died. She had cancer and she died when I was in graduate school. And so like, that's sort of how I think about the differences, like sort of being aware of the economics. And then also like really sadly of the 8 or 9, black and queer, mostly queer, but all black, you know, other graduate students I knew in various programs, like 3 of them are dead. You know, one was killed by police, one died of cancer, and another one died recently. I'm not sure the reasons why, but it was only 34. And so like, that's much more how I think about, sort of experiences of racism, of seeing the toll that it's taken on the ability to build wealth and to have like a long life.
And I'm wondering, because you have this sort of historical or larger perspective on racism that you've managed to, you know, sometimes overcome personal obstacles that other people may be caught up on, you know, like, cause we talk to a lot of people who've been through all kinds of adversities and face prejudices. And one common thread with all of them, the ones who manage to transcend it, is that they're sort of keeping their eyes on the prize, as a civil rights activist said, that they're seeing the bigger perspective, the bigger picture. And so when you're dealing with not getting a job promotion or facing somebody who's just like irrationally hostile to you as a person, you're not necessarily going to be bogged down by it, because you have a, you know, you're doing this for your sister, you're doing this for your family, you're doing this for a bigger reason.
Yeah, I mean, in some ways, I'm very lucky that I think has played a big role in my life. I'm an extremely hard worker. The Thrasher, so the Thrasher name comes from a plantation. Mm-hmm. The white Thrashers own the plantation. Atlanta was originally called Thrasherville. And the white Thrashers owned the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. They owned the hockey team when it was in town. And they had a lot of enslaved people who were also named Thrashers. The enslaved Thrashers, like, we were known as very hard workers. We were bred to be very hard workers. And so one thing I'm lucky, and I'm grateful for the life that I have, but I'm also very aware that this kind of level of hard work comes with a strong toll. And there's I wrote about this a bit when I was at The Guardian. There's a concept called John Henryism that really speaks to me, and it's developed by now I'm forgetting his field of medicine, but his name is Sherman James, and he came up with this term to quantify. I often deal with much more qualitative research, but he is very quantified research around why do black men, you know, die on average 5 years younger than white men, and so it has a lot to do with hypertension, heart disease. And that's the way I think that a lot of this kind of work ethic manifests itself. My father died while he was in the middle of teaching a class. He worked full time as a teacher. He also worked in my mom's upholstery shop. He had other part time jobs. He'd been in the military before he went to night school to become a teacher. You know, and he literally worked until the second that he died, and he had a blood clot while he was in the middle of dying. I don't want to die this way. Like, I would like to have a retirement someday. I would like to, you know, rest. And that's a really hard thing that we see a lot. And it's become, I think, much more talked about in the Black Lives Matter movement. You know, thinking about what does it mean to teach kids, you know, to be, you know, to feel like you have to have grit, you have to pull yourself up from the bootstraps, and you have to be really hard. And it overlaps a lot, I think, with, you know, issues around black queer sexuality and how hard it is to, you know, to allow yourself to become vulnerable and to allow love into your life and to feel like you can be at peace when you've so often had to be, you know, hustling and working really hard. So it's certainly something that I do, but I would like to not work so hard.
That's why you're in Puerto Rico, right? The island of enchantment. Mm-hmm. Are you in Puerto Rico right now?
Yeah. I'm in San Juan right now.
You're like a block away from my niece. But she's like, said, I don't want to put her on blast. She's like, I don't know if the masks do that much in the X scenes. And I was like, girl, every member of my family's like been honkering down on her. Yeah. And, you know, there's this weird, like, youthful exuberance. Like, I've kind of gotten tired of telling people at the gym and at my work and other places, like, please wear your masks. Please stay 6 feet apart.
Are gyms open in Chicago right now?
Yeah, they have been since July.
Oh, really? Oh, I thought they had closed again. I didn't realize they had opened.
They closed some of the group fitness classes because that seems to be the place where people were kind of like spreading the COVID the most because they were not social distancing. And, you know, you're huffing and puffing and you're in a small room and, you know, you're going to get something like that. But the weightlifting areas and, you know, some of the cardio places are still open.
Well, and this really gorgeous, hunky personal trainer became a media sensation when he told this Trumper, this MAGA red hatter at the gym I work out at in my neighborhood to put on his mask. And the MAGA guy went crazy and started, like, you know, pushing his chest with his index fingers. And the personal trainer is, like, you know, probably 30 or 40 pounds heavier than the MAGA hatter. So he's, like, not scared of him at all, you know? But I'm like, I do this, you know, 7 days a week. Where's my medal? Where's my GoFundMe reward money for telling people to wear their masks, you know? And part
you
of it is
need a viral video.
I need to make a viral video. So I'm like, Mark is following me around with a video camera telling people to wear their masks. But there is, like, you know, there's a pandemic exhaustion, you know, and so it sometimes does help to just think about, you know, the roaring 20s and some beautiful things that did happen shortly after the Spanish flu and the end of World War I. And, you know, happier days where we're able to eat together and sit in a jacuzzi together. And, you know, for this podcast, I listened to old shows that we used to do, and there was a magic of having that person in the room with you that on the phone just can't be captured.
Yeah. I look forward to hopefully being on the pod in person. Yes, in the nut.
We'll have you over for a podcast and for a meal.
Yeah.
Thank you.
I'll make you a nice pasta fagioli. I don't even know what that is.
We'll cook you some nice Puerto Rican food.
Yeah, I'll make you arroz con pollo.
Thank you.
Do you like arroz con pollo?
I do, yeah. I've been eating very well here. Yeah. So.
What is, like, the hot meal that, like, what is the meal to go to, like, your comfort food in Puerto Rico right now?
Well, weirdly, I go to an Italian cafe 3 days a week, and they have salads, and
is it in the Plaza Colón?
It's an Old San Juan.
But where is it located, though? What's the name of the place?
It's right by the Banco Popular. It's called Spiga.
Spiga. Okay. I'll send my niece there and see what she thinks.
And there's a very, very lovely waiter. And it's the kind of place that they only have, like, two tables. It's almost all people working in the Banco Popular coming getting lunch. But it's been so lovely. Like, the people who work there are so nice. And as someone who lives alone, like, it's nice to, like, have people I see somewhat regularly and just, like, gossip about what's happening in the neighborhood. Ricky Martin was shooting a music video a few weeks ago. That was, of course, the big in the neighborhood. That was the big gossip. I've loved going there. And then I walk over to Condado on the weekends. There's a place I go to on the beach, and I just get, a sandwich, but it's right on the water and it's lovely. And the wait staff is really lovely there. I think the thing I found in the pandemic is the nice wait staff is more important to me. I could cook the food at home, but having some interaction with other human beings is very cherished.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's one of my happiest memories in Puerto Rico is just, you know, the amazing food and eating it outside and having the ocean breeze tickle your taste buds. Breeze. And these, you know, beautiful men.
Yes, the men are quite beautiful. So, you know, even if I've had a pretty chaste year, it's at least nice to look at people. And it's really nice, you know, because last night I went down into La Perla, and there was like a salsa dance party happening. Everyone's wearing masks. Everyone's at the music. Everyone's performing outside. You know, it's warm. They're, you know, everyone's showing a lot of skin, and yet they're still wearing their masks. It's very sweet.
You know, La Perla is such an interesting place because growing up in Puerto Rico in the 70s and 80s, it was the forbidden zone.
Yeah.
You know, there were stories that you would hear from people that, oh, you go in there and you, if your car runs out of gas, they will like strip your car and rob you and terrible things will happen. So the only way you can get into the Paradelight, which was, you know, at the time, a very poor neighborhood that faced the ocean in the Atlantic, was to drive in during the middle of a rainstorm in the middle of the night.
Oh, wow.
And, you know, that the Luis Fonsi Daddy Yankee video for Despacito that was filmed in La Perla really, you know, just like Deliverance in some ways, transformed the way the public, even Puerto Rican people, think about La Perla, as, and now has made it this tourist destination. And so I imagine that people who have been longtime residents of La Perla feel very much that, you know, man, you know, stay out of here. This is my town. You know, this is my little area.
Yeah, I haven't gone in there too often, but a couple of times I've heard music and I'm like, all right, I'm going to go check it out. And it's been quite lovely. And it does seem like it's a pretty nice mix of people who live locally and are visiting as well.
Well, it reminds me a lot of the Brazilian favelas, where everybody's kind of living stacked on top of each other. And that whole community is just hanging right on the edge of the Atlantic Ocean in Old San Juan, in front of one of the deepest ocean trenches with the strongest winds. And it's just like, how do people survive? I mean, during hurricanes and bad weather, the history of the Perla is the history of survival.
Yeah.
And you're right there.
Yeah. That was really, it's been, living alone. I feel so like Emily Dickinson, like, I've grown so like kind of to thinking the wind is my friend, being, you know, very aware of the wind, being very aware of the seasons, being aware of the light. And this island is kind of magical in that regard, that the wind it's rarely not blowing. I mean, the only time I thought, wow, there's no wind today. And then there was just like a overwhelming number of bugs, which I thought, oh, normally they're blown away. So,
Yeah, that's the thing. Is like, if you don't grow up in a temperate climate where you have winters to kill all the bugs, you don't understand what insects can do, you know. And in Puerto Rico, it's not just mosquitoes. There's all kinds of things. You're like, I don't even know what this is that's chasing me.
And I grew up in California on the Pacific, and so I feel like I understand much more why it's called like the peaceful ocean. Because the Atlantic out here is not joking around as it comes in towards this island.
Have you gone to the other side, to the Caribbean side?
I did, actually, because I just finished. I turned my book into my editor 2 weeks ago, and then I went to the other side, and I went to Rincon and Cabo Rojo.
Yes.
And it's so gorgeous and so wildly different. It's just so, it's as calm as the Atlantic is wild on the other side.
Yeah. And it's pretty dry too. There's this, there's a great hot springs we would go to, and they recently, like in the past decade, they rehabbed it. So it looks much more, touristy and kind of like more commercial.
Los Baños de Coamo.
Yeah, de Coamo. Mm-hmm. And before, it used to be very kind of like rustic, and the hot water pool was just like this one pool that you'd go
into.
It
was this giant concrete tub. It was very, very modest, very salt of the earth.
Yeah.
But it had all these like inspirational quotes, mm-hmm. like, you know, value humanity, mm-hmm. You know, very like Bernie Sanders kind of mindset. And now it's been paved over. There's a store. It's like slick.
But the waters, the natural waters are still there. And people say it kind of smells like pee, but it doesn't smell like pee itself. But when you absorb the water in your body and then you go to pee, you smell the hot springs, which is weird.
The sulfur.
Yeah. But we were in there one time. We're all just taking this soak, and this older woman, she must have been like 70 years old, and she was a singer from New York, you know, Puerto Rican singer. She lived up in New York, and she started getting into the water. And as she starts to descend, she starts singing this Puerto Rican ballad, and everybody just starts like, everybody was just absolutely mesmerized. And that's what I loved about the island the most, is you have those like really magical moments where people just, they're so into music and song and to dance. And then all of a sudden there's just like a show happening right in front of you.
Yeah. It's been a good place to wait out the pandemic a little bit. And even though I don't see that many people, I do really love seeing all the families here. And I live pretty close to El Morro, so I love seeing people come with their kites. And you know, they're like all these great things you can do pretty safely because it's so windy and everything's outside. All the people are still wearing their masks.
The virus just gets blown away.
Just like your kite. I was one of those 10-year-old boys in El Morro every weekend. Me and my friend Miguel would go there with our kites and fly them.
Yeah, I did it myself. And I didn't lose it. And I got it up into the air pretty high. So I was proud of myself. Mm. I've also noticed there are some very, very cute men who fly kites. Mm-hmm. Who like they just make it look so easy. You know, they're just kind of like standing there chilling with their kite up in the air, barely moving.
Hey, Mary Poppins was saying something. Let's go fly a kite for a reason. Well, you know, the other thing too is like in Puerto Rico, if you're not onto this, a lot of those plazas are gay cruising spots.
I did not know that.
Yeah. So the Plaza Colón, I don't know if it's still that way, but, you know, in Ponce.
No, it's not. It's
the Ponce Plaza still to this day is a gay cruising spot. And there's a really cute ice cream place there that you can go get ice cream and sit down. And you're like seductively licking the ice cream in front of another guy. And, what's your name? ¿De dónde eres? You know. And you're like, hey, I just made a new friend, you know? And that's what's the great thing about being in Puerto Rico and is just, you know, the ability to connect with other people that you don't know and you know, through food, through music, through culture, and you know, everybody's welcome to some degree. Just make sure you know a little Spanish.
Yes.
Doesn't hurt. Steven, it's so good talking to you.
Thank you. It's great talking to you. I did not think when we talked a year ago that we still wouldn't be able to, that we wouldn't have been able to meet yet.
Yeah. You were like, oh, I'll see you in a couple months. I was like, yeah, that's not, I was like, I don't know, Lucy, as Ricky Ricardo would say, you know, I'm certainly looking forward for this pandemic to be over soon, but you know, it's like, I'm worried that we're just unnecessarily stretching things out because kind of like people trying to get off an airplane, you know, everybody's rushing to get out the door and it sort of makes things take
longer. Some of that. I think things will be better in the United States in the not too distant future, but then what we really need to do as well is we need to pressure the U.S. and the EU to stop give into an intellectual property waiver on these vaccines, because they can be what's happening here as quickly as it's happening could be happening all over the world. And it's, of course, not fair and it's unethical that the global South is, you know, there are 100 countries that haven't gotten any vaccine yet. And not only is it unfair to them, it's also not in our self-interest to allow the virus to keep circulating and mutating all over the world. It would behoove us to use this wonderful science that we have and do everyone on the earth as quickly as possible without letting folks die just for corporate profit.
But my capitalism. Steven, thank you so much for talking to us today.
Thank you, Steven.
Thank you. It's my pleasure. Take care.
Uh-huh. Bye-bye.
Dr. Steven Thrasher is now living in Old San Juan, Puerto Rico. You can follow him on social media through the links on our website, feastoffun.com. His new book, The Viral Underclass, How Racism, Ableism, and Capitalism Plague Humans on the Margins, will be published by Celadon Books soon.
Soon.
Coming soon. We typically don't talk about books that are to be published because it has a way of jinxing them, you know? So, but it just felt like a really important time to talk to Steven again and sort of get a bigger perspective about this pandemic that is still raging on.
I reached out to Steven early on, like in January or February, and asked him, I said, hey, listen, it's almost been a year since you've come on. A lot has happened. And you were one of our first guests to really come and really explore the pandemic in depth. And so I invited him back. He's like, I'm writing my book. We'll do it as soon as I'm done writing. And so he came on as the first opportunity that we could have. And I'm so glad that he did, because, you know, he's known so much and he's looked into this extensively.
What are you looking forward to doing when the pandemic ends?
I mean, it'd be nice to be going out when they're like having your mask off and just walking down the street and seeing a cute guy and be like, oh my gosh, he has lips.
What a, right? Exactly. You know? It's like you're going to take the mask off and you're like, keep the mask on. I like you better with the mask on.
You know, to have dinner with friends, to have friends come over, to have, you know, guests in the, come into the home studio. Because, like, some of this is like we have a conversation with Steven now. But, you know, a lot of times somebody comes over, we have dinner together, we'll have a couple of drinks. Maybe we'll even go out. Those kinds of things, to go out to see theater and to see live shows.
To visit there used to be music in this house.
To visit your family, to see all that kind of stuff, you know, just to be social again.
There used to be laughter here. Oh, the joys we used to have. What was it called? Feast of Fun. Oh,
well, I was talking to your mother the other night, and she was asking me, like, why is your mom, my mom, so old? Because my mom's going to be 96 next week. And I'm just like, I think a big part of it is my mom's had a very strong social network her entire life. Mm-hmm. She's had, you know, friends and family and community, and she's organized things. And so she's had all those things keep us together, you know?
Right.
They bond us to one another.
The need to know about other people's stories is what bonds us as human beings and keeps us alive.
And that's what Feast of Fun is here for.
Yeah. You know, I feel like T.S. Madison right now.
Do you?
It's like, yeah, be yourself, bitch. Step your pussy up.
Where's your 22-inch weave?
Suck a dick. Start a business. That's what's going to happen when this pandemic ends. Mm-hmm. It's like people are going to fearlessly be themselves, step their pussy up, suck a dick, and start a business. Mm-hmm. You know, and there is a lot of exciting things around the corner. I know, certainly talking to a lot of young people on the internet, they're just like, I'm going to go to all the raves. I'm going to go to all the drag shows. I'm going to wear all the wigs and do all kinds of outrageous things. And to me, I'm like, you know what? Just take things one day at a time. You know, it's like, don't overplan. Keep it simple.
Yeah.
You know, that's all. Mm-hmm. Maybe start by being yourself first and then stepping your pussy up.
I want to thank everybody for listening. I want to remind folks we can't do this podcast without your support. So if you're not a Plus member yet, sign up today at feastoffun.com/plus, because your contribution to this show is what makes this show happen.
And follow us on YouTube, Instagram, and Twitter, and all kinds of social media. Feast of Fun, we post there. And one of the most vibrant places that our listeners and guests congregate and interact with each other is facebook.com/groups/Feast of Fun. And it's made for people who support the podcast. So if you're, you know, you can get this show ad free. You don't have to listen to any ads. If you just subscribe on feastoffun.com/plus or patreon.com/plus, you can skip all the ads, no more ads. Mm-hmm. And you know, for some people it's like, why is there an ad in the middle of the show? Sometimes, you know, if you're listening to the show like on Alexa or there's other podcast networks that stream the show, we don't see a penny from that.
They
keep all the money, which is really messed up. So if you value Feast of Fun and you want to see Feast of Fun survive and go into the future, consider becoming a member. Feastoffun.com/plus or patreon.com/feastoffun. Thanks for listening.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.